Well, Juan Felipe Herrera is back for a second term as the U.S. Poet Laureate, and back with some big plans. One big plan from his first term, La Casa de Colores, includes an epic poem composed of online submissions from people around the world. One other big plan could be a superhero story for children that could help. They could help write chapter by chapter online. Special needs kids, Herrera wants to connect with them too. And wait until you hear the story about the third grade teacher who changed his life. The Poet Laureate of the United States is in the house, Juan Felipe Herrera. He's the first Latino appointed to the post, and welcome. Congratulations on the reappointment. That's just great news.
Well, thank you so much. It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
You are the child of migrant farmers who went on to become the Poet Laureate of the United States. What do you make of it?
It's impossible to describe. You know, I'm very humbled by Dr. James Billington, who actually called me. I was in Seattle.
And who is he?
Dr. James Billington, head of the Library of Congress, at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And they've changed to a new head librarian.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of your poems, Juan, ends this way. If I stood up wearing a robe in front of my familia and many more on the high steps of the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., and read out loud and signed my poetry book like this, Poet Laureate of the United States of America, imagine what you could do.
That's right. That's a
nice line.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
That's the ending of a new project that I'm working on that's going to come out by Candlewick Press next fall.
And what is it?
It's called Imagine. It's called Imagine. It tells that story of my beginnings to becoming the Poet Laureate of the United States.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment, because you could argue, and I believe that you have, that you wouldn't be here today without Mrs. Lucille Sampson, your third grade teacher. Before you tell us about her, tell us about your first and second grade years and how those were for you.
Well, those were tough years. You know, those were my first years, and I only spoke Spanish.
And you were in an English-speaking school.
English-speaking school. This is in Escondido and in San Diego, California.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the mid-50s, 1955, 1956, Elvis Presley years. They just come out with his records. you ain't nothing but a hound dog.
Sure.
And I guess that's what I felt like, you know. I walked in. I didn't know what room. I didn't know what the school really was all about. I had never really been inside of one. So I went in, I stepped in, and I must have asked a question in Spanish, and the school was already, class was already on.
Mm-hmm.
So I got my first 10 seconds in that classroom where the experience was being spanked and scolded and crying. And that was how I kicked off my first day, first 10 minutes in the classroom.
Because you had the audacity to speak in Spanish.
I had the audacity to speak in the only language I could speak in. And I'm laughing now, but it took me many years to work through that. It took me many years to have the courage to speak in a classroom and learn as I was learning English.
How did you survive? What did you fall back on during those years to get yourself through it?
I must have fallen back on the fact that I wasn't the only one in that classroom. And my mother and father at home, class ended, and I'd go back home and go back to my little cubby hole and trailer room and kind of forget about it and possibly bury it and come back the next day and start over again.
Wow. Mrs. Sampson in third grade was different. How so?
She was the polar opposite. Mrs. Sampson played a lot of gospel music in class. This is in San Diego, Logan Heights Barrio. And so she played the music. We all sang, you know, gospel songs, and we did our work. And she, when I was talking to her recently, she's 95 years old now. And
she was present on the ceremony, your first public reading, once she became U.S. Poet Laureate.
She was. She wasn't sure she was going to be able to go because she said, I'm 95, but I want to go. I want to do my best. So she went with family members, and there she was, and we
the
honored
front row.
Her. Yeah. Front row.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was her turn for sure to be in that front row. So she called me to sing in third grade. That was like talking about Pluto or something. And
you were scared silly.
I was scared silly. You know, it's something I had never done, and it was the opposite of being shut down and spanked and punished. So I came up, and I turned around, and she stood right next to me, and I sang the one and only Three Blind Mice.
Three Blind Mice. I just love that. You were reaching for something.
I was reaching for something. What else?
That was the one thing you could hang on to.
That's it. I mean, yeah. So that's what I did. And then that was already pretty big. Standing up, facing the class, singing a song by myself. Next to my teacher.
And then she said to you something that has stayed with you the rest of your life.
Then she said something that stayed with me for the rest of my life and that I tell everyone I meet. You have a beautiful voice. You have a beautiful voice, she said. And then I turned around to my friend. I go, ¿Qué dijo? ¿Qué me dijo? What did she say? Dijo that you have a beautiful Dijo that que tienes una voz muy beautiful. And I could feel it. I could feel that warmth go throughout every cell in my body. I could really feel that inner glow.
I gathered it was the first moment you had in public school where you felt you had done something on the upside.
That's the first time. And it was so big and so deep and so strong that it lasted all the way until seventh grade.
And even that day, you ran home, you told your parents you had a beautiful voice.
I ran home. But tell you the truth, I kept it to myself.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I kept it to myself. For some reason, the school world was very different than my home world. And I don't know, I had a hard time sharing. Mm-hmm. I had a hard time sharing it. Maybe I did, mm-hmm. but I don't remember doing that. That's something to think about.
Yeah. You tell other people now everywhere you go, you have a beautiful voice. And in fact, your book, The Upside Down Boy, tells your story. You were 8 when your family moved from the mountains down into the city. You really missed the mountains once you came down into the big city. And then what did you miss about the mountains and life up there?
Well, I missed the mountains and I missed those open fields that I used to I live in the trailer as we moved from ranch to ranch in my childhood in the San Joaquin Valley in California. And also miss the just the open landscapes. You know, when you travel, you look out the window, you can feel the air, the sun is coming down, there's trees, there's people, there's open fields, and working in those places. So I kind of missed all that openness. All of a sudden, I was in a room. It was tight. I was sitting down on a chair. Can't really move. So I missed that openness and that big sky.
What did your parents do in those days?
Before I went to school?
Before you went to school, up in the mountains. Yeah.
Well, they worked. They worked. You know, my
picking.
Picking hops, picking grapes, picking lettuce, whatever was available throughout those small farm worker towns in the Central Valley, also in Milpitas by San Jose, Salinas area. So that's what they did. And my father was 66 when I was born. So I look back now, being 67, I go, how could he work in that blistering sun every day with knives and your back is hunched and it's scorching out there and come back home and go out the next day and come back, go out. How could he do that? I have no idea.
At age 66.
At age 66, all the way through his early 70s. I don't know how he did it.
Hey, why did you call that book The Upside Down Boy?
Well, that's how I felt. Mm-hmm. I literally, everything was upside down. As you know in the book, the bell rang and I ran out and I opened up this big brown bag and I took out my big potato burrito, burrito de papas. And I looked around and said, everybody's goofing around. No one's eating. It's just me. Well, okay. Then the bell rang again. I went back in, did class, came back out. Bell rang again, came back out. And I started to play, and everybody else was eating.
You had it all backwards.
It was
all upside down.
Backwards and upside down until I got to the point, because of Mrs. Sampson's support and teaching, that at the end of the year, I sang a solo for the whole school in a gospel choir that Mrs. Sampson put together.
Wow.
So I started at ground zero, and I ended up singing in front of the whole school. And I was no longer upside down.
You know, I'm wondering, Juan, how empathetic you think most Americans are about the immigrant experience in this country, because I have my doubts. One of my students just wrote a story for me in one of my classes up at UMKC. And the student, you know, what he wrote about said that during his year here, this international student, all he said was he wanted to see at some point the inside of an American home. And that never happened for him during his year here. It just hit me when I heard that. I just began wondering about the experiences these kids are having, much less the immigrant population at large.
You know, open doors are not as plentiful as they used to be. You know, the tradition of going to someone's house and saying hello, or people come into your place and saying hello. Oh, yeah, come on, sit down, come on in. That's not as informal as it used to be. It's more formalized in many ways. And I also feel how you, a bit like you may, like I think I do, how you felt of that student that was here that long and never got invited mm-hmm. to come into an American home as he was desiring to see. You know, the immigrant experience is very complicated now. You know, we all come from immigrant experiences and migrant experiences and families. And we're different, and yet we share many things. You know, Mexican immigrant experience is very unique in many ways. It's a migrant experience, following migrant family trails for generations. It's also an immigrant experience because the border is up. We're no longer owners of land here like we used to be historically mm-hmm. before 1848. It's no longer Mexican land or Mexican Indian land. And we're also indigenous citizens since we have indigenous roots. Yeah. So it takes a bit of breaking through to pick up on all that. And we don't have the material. We don't talk about it. And it's not a daily topic.
Juan Felipe Herrera is my guest. He's the U.S. Poet Laureate. He'll be speaking at 6:30 this evening at the Kansas City Public Library, the Central Branch, 14 West 10th Street. For more information or to ensure yourself a seat, go to kclibrary.org. That's 6:30 this evening at the Central Branch downtown, a great way to kick off your weekend. You know, I read, Juan, that you were so poor when you attended UCLA that you used to carry your books in a cardboard box with a rope around it. I'm guessing maybe you were a little self-conscious. You must have been.
That was my Chicano briefcase. That was my Chicano briefcase.
Yeah.
When I first got to school, this is like the first time, you know, you come in a bus from downtown Greyhound. And I came in from that Greyhound from San Diego, California, San Diego High School. And I had a cardboard box with clothes in it and tied together with a rope, which wasn't an unfamiliar way of putting things together for me. It was typical.
Yeah.
Or a colored jute bag, which was more nice, good looking.
Mm-hmm.
And also I borrowed a suitcase from one of my friends, Alurista, which was his father's suitcase, which he must have purchased at a thrift store. So I had a kind of a 50s or 40s suitcase, kind of yellowish with stripes. Then I had my cardboard box, and as I walked into campus and ended up in the maternity ward thinking it was a dormitory.
Wrong building, perhaps.
But it was, you know, it was a generative room, you know. It was a creative room, so I wasn't too far.
But at the same time, when you arrived in San Francisco in the late 70s, you thought you'd conquer the poetry scene. You were self-confident despite all this? Do I read that right?
Yeah, but you know, by then, I had my.
You're out of school, and
I'm out of school. I've been reading and writing for since I was 16. You know, at middle of high school, I got into the writing scene, and writing clubs, and Cool and Scroll, and then just being out in the streets with all the civil rights poets. So by 79, I was definitely into it, and I told my friend Francisco Alarcón, who passed away in February this year from stomach cancer. He's a great pioneer. We were both at Stanford. I said, Francisco, we're going to San Francisco, okay? Let's move over there. Because my mother was in San Francisco. Let's go. Okay, let's do it. Let's get out of the dorms out here. Because we were kind of like a student village. Okay, let's do this. So we made it to the Mission District. I was familiar with it since the 50s. And So what are we going to do? We're going to conquer the poetry, San Francisco. We're going to knock on every door, and we're going to read in all the cafes. So that's what we did, and it was beautiful. It was a beautiful experience.
How close did you come to conquering the poetry scene? Did you make it?
I got conquered by it.
Did you?
I got caught, which was the perfect thing.
Yeah.
You do want to get thrown around by all the poets. You want to meet them all. You want to go to the cafes. You want to see them and learn and how they do it. Jack Hirschman and Steve Abbott and Karen Brodine, mm-hmm. and on and on. City Lights and South of Market. And the Castro and the Mission District, all that was boiling and steaming with poetry. So it was a perfect time. But conquering, I guess, just meant opening the door and knocking on the door. That was a big conquering.
Did they critique you? Did you spend time with them? Did they say, hey, kid, think about this or that?
That really, it's all positive. Mm-hmm. You don't really hear that. You go to a reading, everybody says, hey, that was really good, you know?
Yeah.
It's just pure inspiration. It's like swimming in 7-Up. It was just pure inspiration and being supported. And maybe once in a while, I like that title, or what did you say in the middle of that poem? You know, I don't know what it means. Maybe that's about as critical as it got.
I think I want to go swimming in 7-Up sometime. I like that.
You can drink it at the same time. You're never going to drown.
What a concept.
You're never going to drown.
Juan Felipe Herrera is our guest. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here if you want to join our conversation. Why did you gravitate to poetry? What was it about that form of expression that grabbed you as firmly as it did?
Well, you know, you're right. It did grab me, and I did gravitate. I was a lost star, and the only place I could gravitate to was poetry, because it's the only thing that made sense to me. It's the only thing I could feel. I could believe in. It was about believing, and it was about experimenting and creating, and it was about joining a wild, amazing tsunami of poets and writers and artists and muralists and community activists. It was many things. It wasn't just poetry. It was all those other things. It was people moving forward to bring about beautiful change in our communities, our cities, and the world. So it was a big task, even though it was poetry.
Yeah, you know, I've always wondered why poetry hasn't assumed a more popularity in the country, given the fact that it's such an effective way to communicate so openly and honestly at a time when our society, you know, the younger generation, my kids, are moving so rapidly into that space, this idea of uninhibited expression, which certainly my generation never really wrapped its arms around.
Well, you know, we have a lot of pockets and archipelagos and states of poetry in the United States, and it's all over. It's like capillaries. They're bursting capillaries that create arteries. And it's beautiful because the young people, as you know, have spoken word slams. They have poetry clubs. They compete. There's a national poetry program sponsored by Michelle Obama, and they compete for that. And there's the Youth Laureate laureateships that are sprouting in almost all the cities and states. And they're amazing poets. I just read some and judging them for the LA Poet Laureate position. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't believe how powerful and wild and how much they do, because you get to see the resumes. They're in a lot of poetry community projects. They do poetry for seniors. They do poetry in the schools. They do poetry clubs, youth clubs of poetry. So when you look at that, you really feel that it's a big undercurrent and overcurrent. But in other places, it doesn't seem to be around, but it is.
Hmm. Well, and you started poetry when you were how old?
I started when I was writing it and really getting into it. I was 16. I started messing with words on paper when I was in eighth grade.
Yeah.
And I started reciting at home a much younger age.
Well, you brought some poetry with you. One of them is, Are You Doing That New American Thing? You want to read that one for us?
That's true.
Yeah. What would set it up for us?
Well, you know, when I was walking into the office, somebody asked me, I think it was Natasha. She said, Juan Felipe, I really want to know one thing. I know you're the Lord of the United States, but I want to know, are you doing that new American thing? Are you doing that new American thing? Sweet thing, handsome thing, that thing about coming out, all the way out, about telling her, telling him, that we must kill the revolutionary soul because it was only a magical thing, a momentary thing, a thing outside of time, a 60s thing, a sacred thing, a brown beret thing, a white radical thing, a loud thing, a spontaneous thing, a Vietnam thing. Remember the Vietnam thing? Are you doing that? An Aslan thing, that sacred city thing, a Cholo thing, a nationalist thing, a Pocho thing, speaking English and speaking Spanish and not speaking anything thing, a college thing, a Chicano moratorium thing, you know that thing that happened in 1970 in L.A. about Vietnam, an outdated thing, a primitive thing, a sweet thing, handsome thing, you know that thing about coming out all the way out on a communist scare thing, a red thing, and let's go back to war thing because we need to stop all that, you know, terroristic thing because it could lead to another explosion thing, you know, another war thing because we need Reagan. Let me go back to that, okay? We need Reagan and order in the Americas thing. Are you doing that American thing, Juan Felipe? That chains, pins, and leather thing, that aluminum thing, that Lonely Boulevard thing, that transparent plastic underwear thing, that hopeless existentialist thing, that neo-Paris melancholy thing, Juan Felipe, the nightmare thing, the urban artist thing, the laughing thing. Ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha. Are you doing that thing? The serious suicide thing, the new American Chicano thing, the end of the world thing, the victim thing, the enlightened quasi-political thing, the university hustle for the pie thing, the we are the community thing. Are you doing that new American thing, the nacimos para morir thing, the we're born to die thing, the yo te protejo thing, I'll protect you thing, the quien sabe thing, the I don't know thing, the who knows thing, the Dios y hombre thing, the God and man thing, the todo se acaba thing, everything's over thing, the la vida es un misterio thing, life is a mystery, the quisiera ser, I wish I could, that thing, the vato firme, the cool dude thing, la chavala de aquellas, the cool chick thing, that thing, no me toques thing, don't touch me thing, the no quiero problemas thing, I don't want any problems thing. Are you doing that new American thing, the be clean, be seen by the right people thing, the be macho again because women like it anyway thing, the look out for number one because you tried the group thing, the army thing because it really pays more than the hanging around the barrio thing, the women's draft thing because you can do it better than the men thing, the purity thing because no one got to be president by eating greasy tacos thing, the spa thing because there you will meet the right tall and dark and brown and blonde and tender thing. Are you doing the homophobic thing because you cut yourself lusting at an aberration thing? Are you doing that new American thing, sweet thing, handsome thing, that thing about coming all the way out, about telling her, telling him, telling us that we must kill the revolutionary thing?
Wow. Juan Felipe Herrera reading his 1979 poem, Are You Doing That New American Thing? You know, your poetry is a little different than what people might be used to. I get the sense you aren't trying to be fancy with it, Juan, or pretty necessarily. You also write a lot in a mix of English and Spanish. How did you develop your style? Just from repetition and doing it over and over again?
You know, it was, of course, I did it over and over again.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's also, remember, it's a civil rights moment when it's all about coming back to honoring and actually expressing ourselves, you know, just good old-fashioned expressing ourselves the way we express ourselves. And take, you know, not imposing a mask, you know, expressing ourselves. We know English, we know Spanish. So let us write in English and Spanish. Mm-hmm. And let us write the Spanish that we know. You know, it's Spanish before Spanish one. It's kind of homegrown Spanish. It's farm worker Spanish. It's California Spanish or Texan Spanish. Yeah. There's a lot of Spanish-ish going around.
Yeah.
So that was the idea.
You seem to get inspiration from everywhere. I mean, from Mexican corridos to Polish post-war poets. You go all over the place for what you write about.
You know, the post-war Polish poets are amazing. Tadeusz Rosewicz, the great poet, has a poem called The Survivor. And it's direct. He says, I don't like ornaments on my poetry. And when I read that, I go, well, that's interesting. Because I like, at that time, and I still do, I like to experiment and play with language. And he goes, yeah, I don't do that. He goes, I just want to talk about this table. Mm-hmm. See this table? I want to talk about this table. And at his last four lines in that poem, the survivor are, at 24, led to slaughter, we survived.
Hmm.
There's no ornaments there.
Right.
And yet it comes at you like a hammer and knocks you down. So I began to examine that and appreciate that, and the poets and their experience.
You go to a phone call here. Sonia from Gladstone's been holding on. Sonia, good morning.
It's local. Here's the thing about
yeah, Sonia there? Hello, Sonia? We don't have her. You cover, you know, so many different topics in your writing. Is anything off limits for you?
I want to expand as much as possible. There's things that are off limits, of course. I don't like to talk about people's religion. That's not my thing.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I've kind of glossed over it maybe 30 years ago, but I wouldn't do that now. It's a private matter. You know, I respect people's religion. I respect people's culture.
Yeah.
Otherwise,
yeah.
Everything is is on limits. It's inside the limits. I was talking with a student recently on one of my travels I believe it was Seton Hall. And she says, I'm from Pakistan and I'm also Mexican. And, I think I like the Qawwalis, the marriage poetry that are written and spoken and sung in Urdu language.
Mm-hmm.
And then we talked about The Prophet by Khalil Gibran, the famous book of the 60s till today. I go, why would it be still popular for you today? It came out in the 60s. She goes, because it has the melody of the Quran in it. And I had never thought of that.
Interesting.
So it's good to know that. It's good to appreciate each other's way of speaking and listening.
Well, Juan, what a pleasure to have you here. Thanks so much for your time, and good luck in your second year tenure of your stewardship as U.S. Poet Laureate and your tenure there. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Again, you can see and hear Juan Felipe Herrera tonight at 6:30 at the Central Branch of the Kansas City Public Library, 14 West 10th Street, kclibrary.org for more information.